I didn't know that was an auspicious year at the time, but it turns out that because I went to college September of 1995, I, a New Orleans boy, never once experienced evacuating from a hurricane. 1995 was the year we now know that the Atlantic Ocean kicked back into the active cycle or the active phase of hurricane activity, and if you leave New Orleans in September of that year, the peak hurricane month, you very likely will miss experiencing a hurricane.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, Chris Mooney talks about the uncertain relationship between hurricanes and global warming. His new book is called Storm World. It tells the story of a national debate that's become as fierce as a Category 4 storm, and a largely unsuspecting group of scientists who get drawn into it. Reviewers say Storm World proves Mooney's skill in transforming dry data into riveting stories. His first book, The Republican War Against Science, was a best-selling and, frankly, partisan examination of how the Bush administration has manipulated stem cell research and information about condom use. But Mooney says Storm World is different. It's less argumentative and more personal. When he visited New Orleans after Katrina in 2005, Mooney said house after house looked ransacked by the creature from the Black Lagoon. One of those houses was his mother's. This discussion of Storm World took place in July of 2007 at the Politics and Prose bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for coming out. A thought recently crossed my mind, another sci-fi fantasy analogy, which is that if George Lucas wanted to make a series of movies entitled Hurricane Wars, and this would be a series of movies about the ongoing battles between the scientists, a small number of scientists who intensively study hurricanes, Lucas would have enough material already for not one, but two films. And the first film might be entitled Episode One, A New Strife. And this would be about the battle over the relationship between hurricanes and global warming. And for this, Lucas could just adapt my own book, and I'm looking forward to hearing from his people. The second book might be entitled Episode Two, Attack of the Forecasters. And this would be about the meltdown at the National Hurricane Center, which I think many of you may have read about in the news, the director Bill Proenza being put on leave after what was essentially a staff revolt. And I'm happy to take questions about that subject at the end, but this talk is going to be exclusively episode one. Also, for those of you who know me already and know my previous book, I ask that you bear with something of a change in tone here. I'm used to be something of a fire breather and something of a troublemaker. And my last book, Republican War on Science, was a loud cry of outrage, a loud demand for reform, but I didn't really feel like writing a sequel. And Storm World is a very different book. It is more personal. It's less argumentative in nature. And at the outset, what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about how I got there, or how I got from this book to this book, which honestly, in some ways, I like better, and frankly, which I think embodies my hope of proving that readers today in our endlessly polarized and politicized world still do want to hear messages that aren't necessarily just black and white, and your support suggests to me that they do. So here's how Storm World came into being. I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and then I went to college in 1995, and I didn't know that was an auspicious year at the time, but it turns out that because I went to college September of 1995, I, a New Orleans boy, never once experienced evacuating from a hurricane. Surprisingly, but 1995 was the year we now know that the Atlantic Ocean kicked back into the active cycle or the active phase of hurricane activity. And if you leave New Orleans in September of that year, the peak hurricane month, you very likely will miss experiencing a hurricane. But while I was at college, I began to notice my mom was starting to evacuate, not every year, but not infrequently. I remember Hurricane George in 1998. It missed New Orleans, but it killed hundreds in the Caribbean. And hurricanes do create sort of an odd logic. And after the storm missed New Orleans, the local paper, the Times-Picayune, ran an article about people living in New Orleans who said that God had saved the city. And my mother was actually quoted in the article providing a counterpoint, and her perspective was, well, that must mean that God really hates Dominicans. So then came Ivan, 2004. As I relate in the book, Ivan spent 192 hours at Category 4 intensity or higher, meaning that it was, at the time, the record global storm for longevity plus intensity. Kind of a scary thing, although it only took 2 years to break that record. My entire family, again, had to evacuate for Ivan. Our technology was up to speed. Nobody had cell phones at the time, and so we couldn't find out where anyone was. It was a big crisis. The New York Times on the front page was talking about the Atlantis scenario, And then Ivan swerved away, but everyone noticed this threat and was paying a lot of attention to it, except now we know perhaps FEMA somehow managed to miss all of these headlines about how New Orleans could have been inundated in Ivan. So Thanksgiving, after Ivan, 2004, I went home. I wanted to write about the vulnerability of New Orleans, and I was out traipsing around on the levees with an LSU hurricane expert. And then nobody wanted the story. And I won't tell you which magazines didn't want it. I won't name them by name, but suffice it to say that I only managed to run this article about how we should save New Orleans before it's too late, how we need to think big about hurricane protection. It was published online by the American Prospect 100 days before Katrina, which came along and destroyed my mother's home. But as I went on tour, my brother, his wife, and their dog were holed up in my D.C. apartment as I went on tour talking about Republican war on science because they'd had to evacuate. And it was around then I noticed for the first time that scientific research was beginning to link intense hurricanes to global warming, and my initial instinct was, what a nightmare. We're not only going to be, you know, suffering the consequences in the United States, but globally, it's not nearly as widely known as it ought to be that hurricanes take the most tremendous toll in the developing world, where they frequently kill lots and lots of people. That doesn't happen very often in the United States anymore, Katrina being a very unfortunate exception, but usually they damage property in our country. But in places like Bangladesh, you can kill many thousands of people with the right or the wrong storm. Then I began digging deeper, though, into the science on the hurricane-climate relationship, and I saw there was a very vigorous debate here over the data. In fact, this had probably become the most contested issue in meteorology in a decade. An extraordinary scientific battle was playing out in real time before my own eyes, and the battle was being fueled by methodological differences between scientists, by political interference with science, the subject of my first book kind of carried over into this story. Special interests on both sides were twisting the information every which way, and the weather itself kept intensifying the debate. So all these factors sort of swirled together and gave us the hurricane that was the hurricane global warming debate. And that's the story that I wound up telling. It's not a story of blame, of good guys, bad guys. It's a story of science getting swallowed up by the media, by the political system, and of the scientists who found themselves suddenly, unexpectedly in some cases, at the center of the eye, what they experienced, what they learned. It's the kind of story that I think has large implications for how we think about important, but also unsettled, uncertain scientific issues. In fact, it epitomizes, the hurricane climate debate epitomizes the kind of complex scientific slash political slash media debates we're going to have to grapple with far into the future. So let me tell you a little bit about the debate itself and how it played out. The question of how hurricanes fit into the climate system, whether the changes the climate would change them and how, has been studied going back at least 20 years seriously by scientists, by meteorologists, but it wasn't until the dramatic 2005 hurricane season in the Atlantic that it suddenly exploded to public attention. And why was that? It was because of the weather. Not only did we have four Category 5 storms, including Katrina, but as the former National Hurricane Center director Max Mayfield likes to joke, there were so many storms in the Atlantic in 2005 that we had to start naming them after fraternities. And so we had Alpha, Beta, Delta, Gamma, Epsilon, Zeta. And back before I paid a lot of attention to this, I thought Zeta was the end of the Greek alphabet, but that was not the case. Amid all of this, not one, but two scientific papers came out in leading journals saying for the first time that hurricanes had measurably intensified and that this could be proven with data. One of the papers from Kerry Emanuel of MIT, he's one of the sort of main characters in the book, if nonfiction books have characters, and he said that the total power dissipated annually by hurricanes had increased. He showed a strong trend correlated closely with rising ocean temperatures at the sea surface. And then Peter Webster and colleagues at Georgia Tech University and at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and they're also, quote, characters, use a different methodology to get more or less the same result, showing just essentially a counting methodology and showing an increase in the total number of Category 4 and 5 storms over the past several decades. And even as for the first time the science started to say hurricanes had intensified and they could show this with data, what did we see but the most intense hurricane ever measured in the Atlantic? And that was Wilma, late October 2005, 882 millibars minimum sea level pressure. That's the lowest pressure has ever gotten in the Atlantic that we've measured, although not globally. That mistake is often made. We've gotten it lower out in the Pacific with the super typhoons. In response to both the weather and the science, the volume of media attention to this issue, and we actually crunched the data on this for the book. The chart is on page 151. The amount of media attention resembles the wind speed measurements of a tropical storm that kind of meanders weakly along and then hits a patch of warm water and rapidly intensifies, which is exactly what Wilma did. And the patch of warm water was Katrina and the media feeding frenzy that ensued. In fact, the image of a cyclonic storm became the new leading icon of global warming. And that is epitomized by the movie poster for Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. I don't know how many of you have seen the poster. It's got a hurricane being belched out of a smokestack. And I'm a big supporter of Gore. I think he's 97% to 98% right about the science. But I do like to have a little fun at his expense, because it turns out that hurricanes, as many of you may know, rotate counterclockwise in the Northern Hemisphere. But on the poster of Gore's movie, he's got it rotating clockwise. And I went down to Melbourne to talk to the Bureau of Meteorology about this in Australia, and they got a kick out of it when I said that Al Gore was doing a shout-out to the Southern Hemisphere. Now, permit a bit of a digression here, because this is something that drives me crazy. Many of you have heard that water rotates differently in sinks and toilets when you cross hemispheres. You've heard this nonsense. Okay, it's not true. It's true for hurricanes, but as I like to say, if it actually happened on that small a scale, then every time you took a step, you would turn into the Tasmanian devil. And every time a long jumper tried to jump, he would miss the pit. So this is not, at the scale of hurricanes, the Earth's rotation does create cyclonic effects, but at the scale of a toilet, no, it does not. So the truth is that even as Al Gore was helping turn hurricanes into an icon of global warming, even as some scientists said storms were changing and they could show this, other scientists, top scientists who studied hurricanes for a long time, disagreed. And they pointed out very validly that the way that we measure hurricanes globally, it was not as good in previous decades as it is today. And in fact, we measure them differently in different basins using different techniques. The Atlantic is the only place we fly planes into them, which is the best way of measuring how intense they are. And so changes in human measurement practices could well have introduced an artificial trend. And when scientists thought they saw increasing hurricane intensity, what they might have just been seeing was errors and biases introduced by the different measuring systems. So we had a scientific divide, and it turns out that the two camps in this debate mapped very neatly onto a scientific schism that goes back more than a century in the field of meteorology. And the nature of the divide, I think, is well captured in a quotation from the physicist Ernst Rutherford, who said that all science is either physics or stamp collecting. And this is a little bit unfair to the stamp collectors. But what Rutherford means is that some scientists, the quote physicists, they're really good at math, equations, and today climate scientists running models that embed lots of equations and iterate them out, you know, many, many times. And they use this mathematically based understanding to sort of explain observations. And in the hurricane climate debate, the physicists are perhaps epitomized by MIT hurricane theorist Carrie Emanuel, who has derived the heat engine theory of hurricanes, a thermodynamic theory that explains that they get their power from the warm sea surface. They cycle it up to the cool atmospheric outflow region. They use it to do work along the way, work being the driving of winds and all of the consequences that can ensue from that. So these scientists actually expected, based upon their theory, that hurricanes should intensify, and then later the data was found that seemed to affirm that theory. On the other hand, the stamp collectors, if you will, there turns out to be a long and very heroic empirical or observational tradition in hurricane research. These are the guys that go out and collect perhaps the rarest, hardest to get stamps on Earth, the stamps you can only get if you fly an instrumented aircraft into a hurricane and take measurements from it. And these scientists, many of whom had the storm flying experience, they knew just how hard it is to get this kind of data. They knew how calibration errors could totally mess it up. If you don't adjust right for the speed of the plane, then you're not going to get the speed of the winds right. All these kinds of things. They knew how the instrumentation on the aircraft had changed over many years. They knew that other parts of the world didn't even use aircraft, or we cut off aircraft reconnaissance in the Pacific in around 1990, so the measurements before and after that cutoff are totally hard to compare because of that. So they knew all the problems with hurricane data. They themselves have been involved in gathering it, and so they doubted that there really was a valid trend here. One of the empiricists turns out to be something of an incredible character, and he's the one that everyone sort of remembers from the book, and all the reviews so far have pretty much mentioned him. This is Bill Gray of Colorado State University. One scientist referred to him to me as the Howard Stern of meteorology. He's been in this field 50 years, trained dozens of students, a lot of the top hurricane scientists of the next generation, and he's not afraid to say what he thinks. He rejects global warming outright and does so in such a colorful way that you almost want to go over to his side. And he holds forth before huge crowds at the National Hurricane Conference every year, where he puts out his predictions for how many storms there are going to be in the Atlantic that year, and you read about those predictions in the media. And when he holds forth, he doesn't hold back. And interestingly, when he's talking to groups of scientists rather than groups of emergency planners, where you might expect the crowd to be more hostile, and a lot of people accept global warming in these audiences, Gray doesn't change what he says one bit. I'll give you a quote when he was talking to a group of scientists. He said that any experienced meteorologist that believes in a climate model of any type should have their head examined. They really should. And after sort of piling on this kind of stuff, saying that scientists are prisoners of the Clausius-Clapeyron equation and things like that, which you'll learn more about in the book, he ended by saying, "And I'm really sorry I'm so reluctant to express my views on things." So my conclusion on Gray was I really enjoyed hanging out with him and hearing his stories about the heroic days of hurricane research, his first flight into a storm in the 50s, and how he later trained his students by making them take a storm flight. But I couldn't agree with him, and I tried to articulate the criticism gently. I quoted Arthur C. Clarke's so-called first law, and I'd like to read that to you. Clarke put it like this: "When a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something is possible, he is almost certainly right. When he states that something is impossible, he is very probably wrong." One fascinating aspect of this debate was it provided a case study of what happens when you add a scientific divide, a real scientific divide, together with a media feeding frenzy of the sort that followed Katrina. And let me show you what happens. I'm going to read to you the headline of a Wall Street Journal front page story from February of 2006. "Cold front. Hurricane debate shatters civility of weather science. Spats so tempestuous, sides barely talking. Charge of brain fossilization." And that was a charge allegedly levied against Gray. The scientists in the debate, whose careers I trace in the book, were, many of them, quite shocked by the nastiness that resulted once the media really started covering this and people were asking other people what they thought of their colleagues, and shocked by the press frenzy, not used to having their phones ring off the hook all of the time. In some cases, they hadn't waded into anything like this before, the global warming debate. And as the Georgia Tech group later wrote in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, even senior scientists are ill-prepared for their first experience mixing science, politics, and the media. So this was really a wake-up call for scientists that there's different kinds of discourse that occur, and a peer-reviewed journal is not at all the same as being on the O'Reilly Factor, or testifying before Congress. And so it was a learning experience for scientists, and the kind of experience that a lot of other scientists could probably get something out of, although it would be unfortunate if they all had to go through the kind of trial by fire that these scientists went through. But as a result of seeing their work discussed in a completely different context than they're used to and getting asked all kinds of non-scientific questions that they couldn't answer in purely technical ways, the scientists involved in the hurricane global warming debate, and this is one of the happy outcomes, they decided to come together and reframe the issue and change the way it was talked about, because they were sick of these stories, scientists fighting, you know, all this nastiness. They were sick of the press shaping it into a conflict frame, which journalists are so familiar with and they sort of default to almost automatically whenever they find anybody arguing about anything. And so the scientists across both sides of the divide, although Bill Gray didn't join this, they released a joint statement. They actively reframed the issue. And the statement said this: "Well, okay, we're arguing about just how much global warming has changed hurricanes, but no matter what global warming is doing, and there's no consensus yet, we are extraordinarily vulnerable to hurricanes in the United States because our coasts are massively exposed and overpopulated. Something like 50% of the U.S. public lives within 50 miles of a coastline. And that means that today's hurricanes, enhanced, not enhanced, can totally cream us because we're so vulnerable. So from a policy perspective, you do not have to wait for us to get to the bottom of this debate. We should be getting ready for the hurricanes of today, and then, of course, leave ourselves open to adding to those defenses as more science comes in about how much sea level is going to rise and so forth and so on, and whether hurricanes will be 5, 10, 25, maybe even more percent more intense on average, whether the numbers will change and all the rest." And the scientists added, I think some of them would add, although it wasn't in this statement, that what we ought to be doing is conducting risk assessment studies for every vulnerable city in the United States that faces a hurricane risk. And those risk assessment studies should take into account changing climate scenarios. You can't predict exactly what the future is going to be like, but what you can do is you can take a computer model. This is being done. It takes a lot of takes a lot of computer power. But the Army Corps of Engineers is doing this for New Orleans. It takes a long time, takes a lot of money. You run hurricanes in your model at these cities along different tracks, different speeds, different hurricane sizes, different intensities, different rainfall, all of those things. You vary all those parameters, and then you start varying climate parameters as well. So maybe the sea level is a little bit higher. Maybe the hurricane is capable of raining more. Maybe the hurricane is capable of achieving a greater intensity. And from this, you don't get, you know, what's going to happen next year, but you get something like what the worst-case scenario would be. And then that's what you start planning for. And this is being done in New Orleans, which is good, but on the other hand, New Orleans has gotten all the attention. There's a lot of other places that are vulnerable to hurricanes that ought to be doing this. This ought to be a national project, but unfortunately, it isn't. It's been done for New York City to some extent, and the results are quite eye-opening, as I tell you in the book. And since we're in D.C., I'll just tell you that some of you may know D.C., Virginia, also very vulnerable to hurricanes. We had a 1933 storm that caused an 11 to 12-foot surge in D.C. and Alexandria along the Potomac. Hurricane Isabel in 2003 caused $125 million in damage here. And the question is, how does D.C.'s vulnerability change under global warming? I don't know. I don't know of the study, but it should be done, and it should be taken seriously, and it's going to obviously have policy implications. There's a takeaway point here, though, I think, that is bigger than the hurricane global warming debate, and that is that this debate is not black and white. There's a lot of scientific uncertainty. You know, there's not good guys and bad guys. That epitomizes the kind of problem we're going to see more and more of, problems with a high level of scientific uncertainty, many complex policy options, and scientists who we need to inform decision-making, not very good at talking to the media or policymakers, and policymakers too cavalier about scientific information, constantly twisting and misusing it rather than taking it seriously. We have to get better at grappling with these kinds of problems because more of them are coming at us. I'm not going to predict what all of the complex science policy problems of the future are going to be, but we can sort of think about some of them that hold potential to certainly erupt into big controversies like nanotech. Geoengineering, this is the idea that if we can't stop global warming by capping emissions, maybe we'll just alter the planet more, put some particles in the stratosphere to reflect sunlight away from the Earth or something like that. That will be a big fight if it actually gets to be discussed seriously and moves out of the realm of sci-fi. Craig Venter's plan to create a minimum genome synthetic organism, which he thinks will have all these interesting environmental ramifications, but a lot of people are going to call him Dr. Frankenstein when he does it. We're going to be a big fight over that if he succeeds. Scientists talking seriously about their plan to create human great ape chimeras, in other words, an organism that has both human and chimpanzee cells in its brain. That's going to create a huge controversy if they actually succeed in doing that. And there's others that I can't possibly predict, but they're coming. And what all of these kinds of issues have in common is that we need scientists in our political culture both to get better at talking to each other and adapt to the kind of realities and constraints imposed by the other and make it a productive conversation. The upshot from these kinds of science policy conflagrations is going to be we never know everything. Science doesn't tell us anything with absolute certainty. We'll probably never know everything about a particular scientific topic, but we're always going to have to take what it is that we do know, translate it, and use it, and inform our decision-making that way. And if we fail to use it just because it's too hard, the science is too complex, or people are fighting over the science too much, it's too politicized to get consensus, if we fail to use the best available information in a timely way, we will have only ourselves to blame for it. And so I will leave you with this thought. We all know 2006 was pretty dead in the Atlantic relative to both what the hurricane forecasts said we were going to see in the Atlantic and also relative to 2004, 2005, very destructive years. Well, that can happen. The weather is hard to predict. El Nino is sort of a switch. If you think about it, it energizes hurricanes in one part of the world and de-energizes them in another. It doesn't make them go away, but it changes. It shifts hurricane activity around the globe as it shifts global weather patterns. So that can happen. We had a surprise El Nino in 2006. What's less known, especially by the people who say, oh, there were no hurricanes in 2006, you know, there must be no global warming. It was a stunning hurricane year globally. There just weren't a lot of hurricanes in the Atlantic, a lot of strong hurricanes in the Atlantic. We had Cyclone Monica, April 23rd, 2006, off the coast of Australia, possibly the strongest storm ever measured in the Southern Hemisphere. We don't know exactly how strong Monica was. We only have estimates from satellite images. They don't fly planes into storms down there. We know that that a storm becoming this intense that late in the Australian season, April is very, very late in the Australian season, is an ominous record broken. We also know that we had later on in August, Super Typhoon Aoki. I write about these storms in the book. And Aoki was noteworthy both because it was the most intense hurricane ever observed in the Central Pacific, the area around Hawaii, but also Aoki spent 198 hours at Category 4 intensity or higher, and that beat the record that Ivan had set 192 hours just 2 years earlier. Now, again, if Kerry Emanuel is right, if there's more fuel for the hurricane heat engine, then that heat engine should be able to burn intense for longer, and so you would expect longevity plus intensity records to be broken. And one that really caught my attention, June 2007, just last month, Cyclone Gonu completely shattered, and not by a little bit, the intensity record for the Arabian Sea. There is no recorded Category 5 hurricane for the Arabian Sea, but now we've got it. You look back over the records, the previous storm was not even close. The records aren't good, to be fair. There may well have been one 100 years ago, and we might not know about it. But for our records, this is another shattered record. So hurricane intensity records globally have been breaking in the different regions. Wilma was another one. We just set the Atlantic record. And in fact, other types of records are breaking as well, such as the regional distribution of storms. So Gonu also made it to Oman, and this was something new. And we had one off the coast of Brazil in 2004, which was both an intensity record and a regional distribution record, because they have no record of hurricanes off the coast of Brazil. So storms like this, storms like Wilma, Monica, Aoki, and Gonu should raise the question, is something happening out there? Is the world changing in a dramatic way? Or is it just the fact that we have better measurements now than in the past allows us to detect these things that we might not have detected earlier? And I cannot answer that question definitively, but like the scientists in the hurricane global warming debate did, I can reframe that question. And I will reframe it like this. Do you see these broken records and doubt that anything odd is going on? Or do you see these broken records and worry that something odd is going on or might be going on? And I think that's a decision that I'll leave up to everyone here, but I'm not afraid or embarrassed to say that when I look at the shattered records, I am concerned. I know that I can't show definitively with data and prove it to a statistical test that something is happening necessarily, at least to satisfy all the skeptics, but it's worrisome. And not only is it worrisome, but I'm convinced of one thing above all others, and that is, not only is it fundamentally rational to think about what the worst case scenario might be, but it's fundamentally irresponsible not to think about what the worst case scenario might be. And I'll end there. Thanks.
It's really hard to deal with ambiguity. And as Americans, I think we've become less tolerant of ambiguity. Yeah. And I think that's the big problem with dealing with global warming, because mm-hmm. we see, one season, as you say, the hurricanes are very frequent, and then the next season they're not as frequent. And science, by its nature, I used to be a biomedical research librarian, and so I'm a little bit aware that science, by its nature, is not cut and dried. And I think part of our problem is, how can we communicate this ambiguity to the non-scientist so that he or she can deal with the ambiguity as being a realistic part of the whole equation?
Well, that's what this story really brings out. It's rife with uncertainty, but the uncertainty about what exactly is happening to hurricanes is not a reason to do nothing. In fact, hurricanes could be changing in so many ways. Size could be changing. Numbers of storms could be changing. Intensities could be changing. Regional distributions could be changing. There's so many variables that haven't been adequately studied that you cannot say exactly what's going to happen. But you should be worried, because they're going to change. Global warming changes everything, almost, and certainly will change hurricanes because they're driven by heat. So what do? You have to get across this idea that the lack of absolute knowledge is not tantamount to paralysis. That in fact we never know everything, and we never will, but we have to act. This is the fundamental nature of science and reality. We have to use the best knowledge, and we do it all the time in our lives when we don't know everything, but we sort of say, okay, well, this is probably what makes the most sense. So we got to get that idea across. The problem is that in the global warming debate, there's been a strategic attempt to sow doubt about the science, which is actually quite well established now in terms of whether humans are causing global warming, although the hurricane debate is much more uncertain than that. And it's playing off this idea in the public's mind, and polling data has shown this, that if people think the science is debated, then they default to being less likely to support doing something. So, you know, as far as we can, we need to educate people about the fact that uncertainty does not equal inaction. There's always uncertainty, you know. There's often grounds for precaution, even in the face of uncertainty. But because a lot of people may not always pick up that nuance, there's also a reason to try to reframe the issues, these issues, to get out of the scientific fight entirely so that you don't even highlight uncertainty. Because for some members of the public, uncertainty will lead them to default to inaction. So we need to reframe the global warming issue and the global warming hurricane issue so that you don't talk about only the technical details of the science. Global warming can be recast as a moral issue. Global warming can be recast as an economic opportunity. If we take action, then suddenly businesses will actually find new ways of making money under new carbon regulations. Global warming can be recast as a public accountability story about repression of science and whistleblowers and malfeasance by the administration. And again, you get out of this sort of uncertainty trap. So we need to do both. We need to both explain that uncertainty doesn't equal inaction, but we also need to get out of sort of the sterile debates that keep the public thinking that scientists are always at war with each other. That's my long answer. Yes, sir.
Thanks. You mentioned that an important question will be how science and politics interact, mm-hmm. whether that can happen effectively. And that makes me think, of course, of the current administration, which doesn't seem to have any capacity for that.
Yes.
Obviously, that's not all governments. That's not even all American governments. But I'm curious, what do you think the prospects are for positive interaction between scientists and politicians?
Well, the prospects are bad in this administration. This administration is almost over. And they don't like contrary fact. They don't like contrary opinions. And if they get it, they'll suppress it, shut it down. We've seen it again and again, most recently the Surgeon General. And it's not just science, right? It's anything having to do with the Iraq War. It's Medicare policy, how much their Medicare policy is going to cost. So they don't like information that contradicts or problematizes where they already want to go. Other administrations will handle scientific information differently, and other administrations have handled scientific information differently. Certainly, we've opened a kind of Pandora's box with the Bush administration. We need leadership that will get us away from those kind of problems. I think that Bush has gone so far in so many ways that probably the next president, Democrat or Republican, will probably not, you know, err quite as far, just because I think there'll be a correction, unless we sort of elect the Sam Brownback style Republican, doesn't even accept evolution. But I don't think someone like that's going to win nationally in the United States. I don't think that's a likely scenario. But we also have to put in place safeguards that prevent this kind of malfeasance. And there's various kinds of, in a different talk about the war on science, I talk about some of the policies. But the broadest thing is that we have to establish some kind of respectful distance, which completely was lost and collapsed in the Bush administration, between the people who have some kind of expert knowledge and who are supposed to use it to perform some sort of task, civil servants in the government, agencies that specialize in science technology, and political appointees who are answerable to constituents. Okay, and the problem with the Bush administration is that the political appointees were consistently lording it over the scientific experts, leading to all kinds of clashes which frequently exploded, and you saw them on the front pages of the paper. So the government has to be restructured in some way to take power away from political appointees and respect expertise again. And that's a big problem, but it needs to be done at a lot of agencies. Thanks. Sir, yes?
You mentioned that no matter how strong the link between hurricanes and global warming, that there were certain practical things that we could do to reduce the population, the infrastructure on the coast,
mm-hmm.
so as to be less vulnerable.
Yes.
When I think about vacation, I always think about going to the beach.
Yes.
Okay.
Lots of people.
What is your feeling about why is that? Do we have to change that basic orientation toward the ocean?
To some extent, we do have to change the you know, a funny review of my book said, why doesn't everyone come live in Minnesota?
Yeah.
It's changing the incentives and the insurance policies that have made it possible for people to build very valuable property in some of these incredibly vulnerable places. But it's also for everyone currently living there. You know, it's not like we're going to bust them out. We need better building codes, better evacuation plans, better investment in hurricane forecasting. We've gotten the errors down in storm path tracking, but the errors are pretty much stable and haven't gotten any better significantly in intensity forecasting. Like all these things, if we're better able to predict where they're going to go, we can get people out, we can save lives, and if we build stronger and we build smarter, then it'll be more sustainable to be in these coastal locations. But we've got a long way to go. And it is the buildup in property in these locations is the reason we've seen the dramatic damage that we've seen. Global warming might have something to do as well, but there's no doubt the societal trend is dramatic of stampeding toward the coast. The scientists called it the lemming-like march to the sea. So that's the policy. The policy is there. You can get there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, and we should cap greenhouse gas emissions for a lot of reasons, but we can also just work on hurricane preparedness. Yes?
So what's going on at the National Hurricane Center?
Right, episode two. Well, the answer is we don't know everything, and there was a congressional hearing to get to the bottom of this, and I think we still don't necessarily know everything. But you had people who did not like working with each other, people who were very, very unhappy under their new director, and they were unhappy about his statements. They were also unhappy about how he was running the office, and now that NOAA had to send in an investigative group because the scientists at the Hurricane Center were complaining, and they did so, and it seems like, you know, there was essentially a staff revolt. More than half the staff or half the staff said, we need new leadership. When something like that happens, you would expect the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is head over the Hurricane Center, to look into the problem. It was partly about a scientific difference between Bill Proenza, the new director, and the forecasters over just how important a particular satellite was to hurricane forecasting. Proenza came in denouncing his superiors and saying, you know, not enough investment in hurricane research, which is right. It's a very powerful message and one that I agree with. The problem is he made a big fuss about QuickSCAT, which measures winds over the distant ocean, and he said if we lose QuickSCAT, and it's running essentially on a backup generator right now, if it falls into the ocean, you know, our forecasts for landfalling storms will be worse. The forecasters said no. You know, when they get close to land, the density of the observation network increases, and we have all these other ways of learning about storms when they're close to land. Our forecasts won't be worse. QuickSCAT's great, but we should bring it back, but we should get a new one, essentially. But don't say that it's going to make our forecasts less accurate. So Proenza, I think he probably stated that too strongly, and that definitely troubled the forecasters. And on top of that, there were all these personal disputes. But the upshot is Proenza was right to say, where is the money for hurricane research? Given our incredible vulnerability, why hasn't there been a dramatic buildup, a dramatic investment in this area? When there really hasn't been. It's staggering when you think about it. In the book, I talk about 54, 55. We had a lot of devastating hurricane landfalls, and Congress passed the National Hurricane Research Project and created it, and then suddenly the government was paying for these storm flights, and that was where we learned so much about hurricanes and where all the scientists now in this fight, you know, sort of built their careers out of. Why aren't we doing a repeat of that? There's still much to learn. It doesn't make any sense to me. In light of the 2004-2005 hurricane seasons, it should be a no-brainer. So Proenza was right about that, at least. Yes?
Hi. You'd mentioned a methodology debate between roughly the physicists and the more empiricists.
The stamp collectors, yes.
Stamp collectors. Is it a dispute over the theory the physicists have, or is it a dispute over their skepticism about how to actually model the theory?
To some extent, the empiricists will challenge the theory, which is the thermodynamic theory of where a hurricane gets its power from. The heat engine theory, which is what leads to this idea that there should be intensification if you heat the oceans. To some extent, some of the empiricists, and I talk about Chris Lancey from the National Hurricane Center, they'll say, okay, well, there might be some intensification, but the theory overpredicts that, and it'll be much smaller. But mostly it was over the data that was being used to show that apparently an intensification had occurred. So in other words, data was suddenly matching theory, or in fact, overmatching theory, that the intensification was much more than the theory said should happen, given the fairly modest warming that we've had so far. And the empiricists said, there's no way this data is right. So they weren't attacking the theory primarily, although they are probably skeptical of some aspects of the theory, too. And there's a lot more detail on that in the book. Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
Two questions. Mm-hmm. First, why aren't other countries flying planes into hurricanes? Yeah. And second, how are the deliberations and disputations about science and politics and climate change and so on and so forth different in other countries?
It's not cheap to do it safely, to fly into storms, and to have the kind of instrumented aircraft that you have to do it properly. You know, in the United States, they're firing, you know, incredible measuring devices, dropsons down to the eye, and they're sampling the pressure and winds. You know, sometimes they'll the fastest wind ever measured by dropson was 239 miles per hour. So that thing isn't even falling anymore. That thing's going like that. So we have a capacity, and we've invested in it in the United States in ways that we haven't in other countries. In fact, the Navy used to do it for the Pacific. They used to actually fly into planes in the Pacific, and that's how we got the lowest pressure ever measured in a hurricane, Typhoon Tip, 870 millibars in 1979. We don't measure them with planes anymore, so there might have been a more intense super typhoon out there. So it's really a societal investment. It does surprise me. There's countries like Japan, Australia. I think they could probably find the resources if they wanted to do so, but they don't. And that certainly complicates our ability to measure. In terms of how the global warming debate plays out in other countries, I mean, I think that in the United States there's been a much more well-orchestrated, concerted attempt to muddy the waters and attack the science. And it has been successful, and it's created a lot of inaction in this country, and there's much more consensus in other countries. And, in fact, they're shocked that we have these sort of established network of skeptics in the United States, and they're constantly trying to out them in the British papers. And they love sort of diving onto the stuff that the U.S. journalists are also making trouble about. So it creates a very different political climate. Australia is actually closer to the United States. Australia has sort of a global warming skeptic coterie there as well. So it does vary by region, but we're all sort of lurching towards action, and some of us are just moving slower than others. Yes?
I'd like to compliment you on your facility of communication of science and politics or policy making, and I'd like to ask you if you would comment about your personal journey, your education that brought you to this articulation, and how might you be a role model for more young people around the world?
Well, I'll tell you how I got here. I don't know about how I am a role model, but it's surprising some to hear that I'm an English major. But there are a lot of science writers out there who are, and my books are vetted actually by scientists not involved too closely personally in what I'm writing about. And so the hurricane book was actually read, all of it was read by various sort of specialists who gave me technical critiques to make sure it doesn't get too messed up, because there's certainly places where I might go wrong, although I try to internalize it as best I can. And this one has gotten marks for accuracy from people who know, so I'm happy about that. But I'm a college English major who gravitated towards science, almost switched majors, became sort of very, very obsessed with history and philosophy of science in particular, but it was too late to really actually do that. And I decided not to do graduate work, and I decided to just get into journalism. I wanted to be a writer above all, but I had a love for science that really went back to my grandfather, who was an evolutionary biologist, quite a colorful character. Reminds me of Bill Gray in some ways, actually. He used to always talk about Chuck Darwin as if he was sitting at the table next to us. So that had it was sort of my background, that sort of science in my background, combined with wanting to be a writer. And so I really stressed the learning to be a writer thing, and got to the point where I felt like I could write about any subject. And then, as a generalist, then I started diving into scientific subjects, where I think the need for translation is often the greatest. And well, that's two books worth, I guess. So, I guess that's the story.
Good evening.
Hi.
I showed up late, so maybe you addressed this. And if you did, I apologize. But my understanding of global warming was that in the last century, the temperature of the air has gone up about 1 degree Fahrenheit. And the big problem is that if we don't do something,
might be more than that.
Then it's going to get worse. But really, you know, it's a degree Fahrenheit in the century. And what you're saying is what you're saying, that small temperature change is causing a drastic increase in hurricane strength.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying scientists are debating over whether the temperature increases.
That one degree.
I don't know if it's precisely 1 degree Fahrenheit. I don't know exactly what it's been. Depends on when you start your measurement and when you end them. It's clearly going like this right now. And all of our reliable theory and models, many of which, and not just models, but basic physics, we understand how the greenhouse works. Greenhouse effect works. We've known for 150 years that certain gases essentially have a heat-trapping effect. The concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are going to increase. And
I understand that.
Yes.
I understand that for the future, but mm-hmm. you're talking about, I mean, I think you're talking about how hurricanes perhaps have increased in intensity, mm-hmm. and the potential cause of that, or a real, as you're saying, a potential real cause of that is this global warming.
A lot of
but
scientists
so
think
far,
that.
It hasn't been much global warming, really, has it?
Relative to what we might get by 2100 if we don't do anything, yeah, it's relatively modest relative to the projections if we really double carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. What's surprising about the data that I mentioned that came out in 2005 was that it showed a dramatic increase in hurricane intensity despite the only fairly modest warming we've seen so far, although it's not insignificant, but it's modest compared to what the projection should be. And scientists were saying, God, how could they have intensified this much already? And then a lot of scientists said, I'm not sure your data is good enough. It might be a data problem. And, you know, I think the truth may be somewhere in between. Before Kerry Emanuel, for example, is one of the main characters of the book, and he designed a theory which predicted that hurricanes should intensify. It's a theory of a hurricane's maximum potential intensity. I've referred to it before as the heat engine theory. But in other words, the maximum potential intensity that a hurricane can achieve should increase, all else being equal, if you have more a hotter temperature at the sea surface, although there's many other things that control that intensity. But he had run models, and he had predicted an intensification by 2100 that was much less than he'd seen in his suddenly in his data. So this is the nature of the debate, right? It's surprising that they would have intensified that much, and a lot of scientists don't accept that. Yes.
Yeah. Now I remember reading about punctuated equilibrium, and isn't that what we were likely to have instead of a little gradual whatever? I'm assuming that what you have is a series of serious mm-hmm. events punctuated with mm-hmm. nothing, then more serious events, and I want you to.
Well, yeah, global warming shouldn't be linear, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
You know, suddenly something might tip, and suddenly a lot happens, and so a lot of scientists, when they saw the dramatic hurricane data, they thought, well, maybe the system is much more volatile than we thought it was, and then others said, well, maybe this is just bad data, and it could have been either, but certainly, in many ways, global warming is starting to hit us faster than necessarily we thought, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Polar amplification, the Arctic is really, really going fast.
Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of things are happening. Whether hurricanes are part of that story, they should be part of the story. Whether a dramatic change has occurred, I think that the fight is still open on that.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, one more. Okay. Hello.
Liked your explanation. I wonder if you address in this book or could otherwise speak to other aspects regarding the way rivers are dumping more water and making our the coastal shelves more a magnet for hurricanes, like Tidwell and others have written about.
You mean loss of wetlands? Is that what you're referring?
Not just loss of wetlands, but in other words, as the delta gets mm-hmm. Lower mm-hmm. and the other ground is subsiding.
Yeah.
From what I've read, that's sort of like saying, over here, please.
All of these trends are kind of, coming together, and they came together to make Katrina happen. So you lost coastal wetlands, partly they were destroyed, partly sea level rise, caused some loss of the extent of the barrier that would have protected New Orleans, for example. And then you had subsidence, too. So you had all the sort of perfect storm of factors just letting the ocean get closer and closer and closer to the city. And fixing the problem is going to involve building back a lot of the wetlands in order to protect New Orleans.
Okay. And, excuse me, how much credit do you give to the Army Corps of Engineers for the actual destruction to New Orleans? Because it was days after the people were coming, it was after people were on their way back saying, whew, dodge that bullet.
Yeah.
When the levees burst.
The Corps, it's clearly the Corps didn't do a very good job protecting New Orleans. I think that there's no doubt about that. We have to remember that the Corps answers to Congress and that it's their fault. And now, if you sort of govern and lead the Corps right, they can do good things. And they're too slow and too bureaucratic, but they are doing the kind of risk assessment study they ought to be doing right now for New Orleans. And someone should be doing that for all the rest of the world. And then you have to keep on them and get them to build the defenses after they've done the study. But as long as there's proper oversight, the Corps ought to be able to work. The problem is that there's been terrible oversight, and there have been all these pork barrel projects, and they've been building stupid things that don't do any good and not protecting cities like they ought to. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.